Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we're going to hear from Greg Shipley. Greg works at an initiative spun up by InQtel called Cyber Reboot. Its goal is to develop open source tools that can push things forward in security, things the private sector isn't currently doing. He'll be telling us about some changes his colleagues have made to TCP dump, which, if they ever manage to get the change adopted, could actually be quite useful to the security community. We speak about some other stuff too, that's coming up later. This week's show is brought to you by Duo Security, and Duo's very own Dave Lewis will be joining us this week to talk about the roadblocks you might face if you're trying to head down the Beyond Corp road to the deperimeterized Nirvana. That is coming up later, with big thanks to Duo Security. But before all of that, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, China's state-owned Costco shipping organization is having a pretty bad time.
Yeah, there are reports that internet connectivity from a bunch of the kind of regional areas where there are offices for the shipping firm have been disconnected. The story during the rounds is that they got ransomware. Of course, we've seen ransomware take out the Maersk shipping line with the NotPetya back in the beginning of this year. So yeah, shipping companies are, you know, clearly easy prey for this kind of thing. There aren't any real confirmed kind of stories about like what particular ransomware it is, how bad it is, how, you know, what's actually going on. But when you're reduced to telling your customers to like email people's personal Yahoo accounts,
oh, that's what I love. They've given
a bad time.
They've given them Yahoo addresses to use in the meantime, and I just love, of all of the providers that they pick, they pick Yahoo.
It's a bad look.
But yeah, apparently Costco staying pretty mum on what's going on. And this Ars Technica report cites an article carried by the Press Telegram of Long Beach, California, which is an interesting source for, you know, authoritative information on what's happening on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, clearly they're scrabbling for info here, but it doesn't sound good regardless. You know, maybe we'll see some explanation as things go further down the track. But yes, if you have a shipping container on the way, then maybe check.
Maybe just check.
Via Yahoo.
Yes. the US government has prepared a naughty and nice list of software suppliers locking out a bunch of Russian and Chinese firms.
Yeah, there's some reports that list exists, but they won't share it with us, which is kind of frustrating. I mean, it's great to have a list. I mean, clearly Huawei and ZTE are going to be on it, presumably Kaspersky. But yeah, the reporting so far, we've seen ZDNet carrying a story quoting an article on Bloomberg. But yeah, there isn't any detail of exactly, you know, what is on this list. I mean, other than the obvious choices. But I mean, really, I guess the story here is that we're seeing the continuation of this trajectory of, you know, having to worry about national interest and origin in our software supply chain, to the extent that that's even a thing we can really understand anymore. I mean, the idea that there is a Chinese comms company or a Finnish, you know, that Nokia is a Finnish company anymore, which is, you know, so far from the truth. Yeah, like it's a difficult thing to kind of quantify. Maybe that's easier with the Chinese, you know, with the Huawei's and the ZTE's, where it is much clearer. But I mean, what's the provenance of, you know, Alcatel-Lucent these days? Who knows, right?
Yeah, where did that code come from? Which branch, which office, which coder, right?
Well, exactly. And then what hardware is it running? Where's that hardware come from? Well, Shenzhen, yeah. Right? Or is it made on a fab in Taiwan? Who knows? You know, if you're a Samsung or you're an Ericsson, you know, where do you make your care? Where is the software written? How do we, as an outside, you know, person making a purchasing choice, supposed to have a conversation about that without the knowledge of the insides of Ericsson?
Well, we had an interview on the show a while back talking about how a lot of these US technology firms have trouble even understanding their own supply chains, right? So good luck to the rest of us. I should clarify, that is just a naughty list. That is not a naughty and nice list. And it's a US government list of software companies that it won't buy from. And yeah, it's all attributed. The whole thing hangs on a quote from the Defense Department's acquisitions chief. So there you go. Now, we've got an interesting perspective here from CyberScoop, and one that I certainly agree with. The headline is "Fighting Chinese Cyber Espionage Could Cost US 5G Dominance." And this is a conversation that is happening in various places, including in Australia, which is like, okay, we want to lock out some of these Chinese vendors from our 5G builds, but how much is our network going to cost if we do that, right?
Yeah, well, it's a very, very real concern. I mean, Huawei are doing well, amongst other reasons, because they're pretty good at making comms gear, and they're very affordable. Their service is better, arguably, than some of the other, you know, Western vendors. And yeah, like, if you want to roll out a network and you want to go buy it off someone that isn't Huawei, it's going to cost you a bunch more. And if you're trying to do it, you know, with only things that, you know, don't involve Chinese supply chain, you're really going to have a rough time. And we know, we've seen over the years, right, this real kind of commingling. You know, we saw it with, like, the ban on providing equipment to ZTE, providing components to ZTE, where, you know, the supply chain from Qualcomm through ZTE then back into the US was, you know, perhaps a thing that people didn't really understand, you know, was how it is. And, you know, everything is so integrated and so complicated when you're looking at, you know, kind of 5G mobile gear that, you know, it's very hard to even kind of think through what it would mean to say we're going to build a 5G network without Chinese equipment in it.
But I mean, that's exactly what's going to happen, you know. Idiots.
Well, I mean, that's where we're heading. But I mean, we're going to end up with what? Like a return to the bad old days where we have, you know, not even interoperable mobile networks, you know, back when the US had CDMA and everywhere else in the world had GSM and you couldn't go to the US with a, you know, with a sensible phone. I mean, we don't want to end up
I kind of feel like the world's learned its lesson. But yeah, I mean, you know, the spec is the spec and what happens in reality might not necessarily meet the spec.
Well, of course, yes.
I mean, if we can't even agree on, you know, I mean, we've seen that in just IP stacks, not necessarily all being the same, you know, let alone something as complicated as telco gear.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, and having it all made in one place, and that's one of Huawei's advantages, of course, is that they can build the whole stack from the handset through the RAN into the, you know, mobile core, and then onwards into the rest of the network. Which, you know, we see a much more piecemeal approach elsewhere. And of course, I mean, China as a central government has a lot of focus on building out, you know, the 5G infrastructure in China as a national infrastructure project. And, you know, to a certain extent, I mean, you know, this kind of infrastructure, because it's so big and expensive and requires such integration, you know, really is kind of a natural monopoly and the sort of thing that a central command economy probably will do a better job of than a free market, you know, everybody makes their own thing, you know, competition sort of, dream that the US would have. You know, maybe the Chinese, you know, system is actually better suited to rolling out this kind of infrastructure.
Hey, look, central planning, I mean, it has its distinct drawbacks, but in some cases, yes, absolutely, there are some advantages there. Kevin Paulson and his colleague Andrew Desidero over at The Daily Beast have written up a report on some attacks targeting a US Senator, Claire McCaskill, who is apparently an outspoken critic of Russia.
Yes, apparently she is a Democrat from Missouri running for re-election. Her seat is not super guaranteed at the moment and has been kind of because of her being an outspoken, you know, kind of critic of Putin and also because of her vulnerability in her seat at the moment has been targeted by Russian hackers, according to the write-up. In this particular case, the hacks consisted of sending a bunch of her staffers, you know, like phishing emails purporting to be from the, like, Active Directory Federated Auth system in the US government. So yeah,
hey, go for gold right off the bat, right? Why not?
Yeah. Like, please change your exchange password on the, you know, Senate ADFS login page, which for this to have worked must be single factor, I point out. And according to her staff, no one actually fell for the fish, but, you know, clearly a bit on the nose at the moment. You know, it's hard not to argue that perhaps the correct thing is, I don't know, deploy multi-factor auth for remote access to, like, the Senate, and that might help a little bit, but it's gotten a bit of press coverage.
I've got an interview in the can. It's already recorded with Bob Lord, who's the CISO of the Democratic National Committee, that I'm going to run when I'm back from my little trip to Las Vegas. So that's something to look forward to there. DHS is warning of impending attacks on ERP systems in the United States, Well, yeah. But I mean, we've got a DHS alert here, which is kind of interesting. And I think one thing that makes this particularly interesting to me is that the US government has sanctioned the Russian linked company that makes basically the only good ERP security tooling, ERP scan. So it's like, yeah, we're about to get attacked. Yeah, good luck. Can we use this tooling? No, we sanctioned it. So, okay, thanks, bye, right?
That is pretty funny. And, I guess as a, you know, someone who's been hacking corporate networks for, you know, quite a long time now, the idea that, you know, this is a thing you'd warn about now as opposed to 15 years ago.
No, but apparently they've picked up some specific activity, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm sure there are people.
Nation-state stuff. Like, this is a thing.
You're particularly nosing around, yes. I mean, if you have you know, your giant Oracle stack on the internet or your giant, you know, SAP stack on the internet, then yeah, you're really, really going to have a bad time. And, you know, to a certain extent, no, there's no tool you can buy that's going to make that better. You just need to not put it on the internet, which is hard advice for people when your whole business runs on it. But, you know, that's what happens when you buy Oracle. So, yeah.
Well, and they're talking specifically too about, you know, them targeting like known bugs and stuff. So it's not necessarily a matter of like better configuring your stuff. It's more a matter of patching it, right? So maybe the ERP scan thing is a bit of a stretch, but still, you get my point.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, there, you know, clearly there are some, you know, things you can do, but I mean, in general, if you've ever looked at Oracle eBusiness, for example, one of my personal bugbears, like it's just so big and so bad that, you know, every bug you squash, there's going to be 100 more, probably 1,000. So, you know, you're just going to have a bad time. And this, you should go, you know, if you admin one of those on the internet, you should take this and go talk to your boss and, you know, accept the risk a few more times.
Yes, just keep signing your name. It's fine.
Yeah.
We've seen another ICO takedown. This one's pretty decent. $7.7 million belonging to apparently investors in this Kick ICO, initial coin offering. But apparently there's a bit of a novel technique here.
Yeah, so this one's kind of strange for two reasons. One is the novel technique you allude to, which I'll come to in a second. The other is like Kick ICO, when we're doing the research for talking on the news, right, I try to go away and read and understand a little bit about the stories we're going to talk about so I can provide informed commentary. And my question was, what the f*** is a Kick ICO? Which, if you do anything involved in cryptocurrency, is a really difficult question to answer. Anyway, as far as I can tell, it's like an ICO platform for doing ICOs. So the Kick ICO is not itself an ICO, except that it's an ICO for a business which makes a platform for other ICOs, all of which is on top of Ethereum in the first place.
Right.
Based in Russia as well. Anyway.
Nested ICOs.
Yeah, so it's like a meta ICO where you invest in sort of it's like Kickstarter for ICOs, except the Kickstarter itself is also an ICO.
I thought I hated it before we started speaking about it, and I hate it even more now.
Exactly, exactly. Anyway, so the novel aspect of this, other than their business model, and I'm making scare quotes there, is that the attackers bust into the platform, stole some private keys, and then caused a whole bunch of the crypto coins, to the extent that they exist at all, caused the coins to not exist anymore. They minted new ones that they controlled such that the amount of coins in circulation didn't change, which is one of the metrics they were using to monitor the security of the platform and then use that to steal stuff. Like, these are not real coins. They're kind of like there's a smart contract involved that they broke into to do this, kind of like destroy some coins, make some new
coins. And what did they actually steal? Did they steal anything useful, or was it just these useless like Kick ICO coin tokens?
Well, I mean, they're on the Ethereum blockchain, so then you can go trade them like regular Ether, but
it's not regular Ether.
Well, yeah. So yes, to answer your question, I don't know if anything of value was stolen. I don't know what their business model is. The whole thing is dumb and we should stop doing it.
When you think about it, though, like this is stuff that is so out there that here we are, you know, supposed like, you know, commentators on InfoSec, and we're like, what even happened here?
Exactly.
Answer it.
I don't know if anyone got any money. The company in question says that they have like returned the coins to people. So yeah, you know what? I don't know. Like maybe $7 million got stolen. Maybe $7 million didn't get stolen. I don't know. Welcome to the future.
Meanwhile, Californian authorities have charged some 20-year-old college kid with doing SIM swap fraud and stealing $5 million in cryptocurrencies.
So, like, here's the thing. At least we can understand this goddamn story, right? So, yeah, kid was doing fraud by going to the, you know, AT&T store, getting the SIMs swapped on people who are kind of high profile in the crypto world, resetting their, you know, Gmail accounts via the SIM, then using that to reset, you know, their accounts on various cryptocurrency brokerages, and then stealing all of the coins. Apparently also took the opportunity to harass a few people, you know, steal their Twitter accounts, steal their Instagram accounts, sell those for money or whatever.
At least he's a committed black hat, right? Like, you know, yeah. If you get a black hat, just commit.
He was arrested carrying a Gucci bag at the airport on his way to Europe, which, you know, real subtle there, guy. Apparently he was tracked, and this actually is one of the more interesting bits. He was tracked because the cops took the SIM, you know, the identity of the SIM, one of the SIMs that had been stolen, requested that the carrier provide the hardware identifier of the phone that it had been.
They got his IMEI number.
So they get the IMEI out of the carrier, and then they correlated that IMEI with a bunch of other accounts that it had used that to identify him, pulled a bunch of his data from the cloud service providers, you know, and found him like taking selfies, of his identity, identity card and all of his money and Gucci bags or whatever, and then arrested him, which I think it does seem that the like forum or board or whatever that he hung out on with a bunch of other SIM swapping kids has basically gone dark now because everyone realizes that phones have hardware identifiers now.
Just about to say, right, like SIGINTers used to have a jolly old time picking up new selectors because there were so many people based in sketchy places doing sketchy stuff that would just swap out SIMs. They'd have their like dodgy, you know, terrorist activity SIM that they'd put into their actual phone, and then it would just pop up on the network. Okay, they've got the device ID, and then they put in their normal SIM, they link it back, and, you know, Robert's your mother's brother, off you go, right? So for a long time, people just did not understand that if you swapped a SIM, that didn't make you invisible somehow.
No, and of course it makes it a perfect select to go show me every IMEI that's had more than three SIMs associated with in the last year. Well, there's your list of bad dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. Pro tip. Google Cloud rolling out a new feature called Shielded VMs. What's this about, Adam?
So this is Google introducing a bunch of like trusted boot and attestation tech into their Google Compute cloud computing platform. So I guess the intent is that you have a bootloader process and, you know, kind of like trusted boot like you would have on, you know, regular hardware where you can kind of verify the integrity of the boot process, which is, you know, in some cases, a thing that people are going to want in a cloud platform. It seems to involve like having like a virtualized TPM and then a custom UEFI BIOS that understands how to boot in that environment.
Well, this is very important that you use this sort of thing when you're about to deploy, you know, your Oracle ERP to the internet.
Well, I mean, this is the sort of the criticism, I guess. I mean, to the extent that it's not really criticism, because clearly adding more security features does, you know, address some issues. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not really the way that most things get owned on the internet. I mean, the problems that they're trying to solve here, I mean, there's a bunch of other security features.
I can think of applications for it. Like, to be fair, I can think of instances where this would be actually quite useful.
Yeah, and I think what we're seeing here is Google rolling out some of their own internal dog food, and making it available for other people to use, which is a really good thing, right?
It's how stuff. Hey, it works for Amazon. They're a bookseller, for God's sakes.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? There's a bunch of other things. One of the ones that's perhaps more interesting is disk crypto tied to this virtual TPM, such that your disk images aren't going to get decrypted unless you're booting in a controlled environment. So it means someone who breaks into your cloud admin control panel
and
steals
clones,
the disk images,
yeah,
or snapshots the disk images, steals them, can't then easily mount them somewhere else to extract the contents, which is one of the more common avenues for, you know, compromising a bunch of VMs in an, you know, an Amazon or a Google account.
That what happened to the DNC's analytics data, right? It was cloned.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's certainly, I think that is one of the more interesting levels of protection they're adding, perhaps, you know, more than the trusted boot by itself, like tying it to the descriptor, I think is a smart thing. So yeah, I think it's, for some applications could be really, really useful. And of course, Microsoft have done some similar sorts of things in Azure as well. But yeah, this kind of whole ecosystem is maturing, which is good.
Yep. Staying with Google, and now this is going to be interesting news for the people over at Yubico, because they're actually starting to release their own hardware security tokens, which is, interesting. I mean, I'd be paying very close attention to this, as I said, if I were Yubico.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Yubico have been in a really good position of being, you know, really the dominant vendor of hardware U2F tokens. Google's internal staff, you know, kind of famously bought quite a lot of YubiKeys over the years. Google bringing out their own competitor, and especially one that they're going to, you know, kind of market and sell as part of G Suite and the other rest of the Google product set. Yeah, I think it'd be bad for Yubico. Obviously, it's really good for the user base in general. I mean, that kind of U2F-based hardware tokens really is the best we've got for authentication at the moment, and anything that encourages uptake of those is going to be really good. And obviously, it'll also push the maturity of the, you know, kind of configuration options and all the other things you get to be able to use those in the wild. So yeah, good on Google, I think, and sucks to be Yubico shareholders.
Well, they're saying they built these things with a secure element that includes firmware developed by Google to verify the key's integrity. So it looks like they've certainly been hands-on with these ones. funds in a pretty massive way. Now, Bleeping Computer is reporting on this malvertising campaign that actually looks pretty serious.
Yeah, this is a campaign. Checkpoint have published a bunch of information about it. They're calling it Master 134 after one of the people or systems or something involved. As far as I can tell, not being a super expert in the internals of advertising, this seems like an interesting platform in the sense that it allows people to serve malvertising, through an ad network, to compromise people with exploit kits or the usual sorts of things, but does so like using the same sort of bidding process that real advertisers do to buy slots in people's browsers in real time on some kind of marketplace, which seems entrepreneurial.
Yeah, innovation. We love it.
Innovation.
But apparently, this thing's like of a reasonable scale too.
Yeah, it does seem that they've compromised something in the order of, 10,000 or so WordPress blogs to kind of vector traffic in, plus a bunch of other stuff. And then, kind of by pushing it through a regular ad network, kind of leverage the, the rest of the ad network to also vector traffic in. And I was a little unclear about how all the components fit together and which bits were malicious and which bits were just kind of like normal business model.
Mm. But apparently these WordPress sites were all running 4.7.1, which is a version that has RCE in it. So, that's the thing. If you don't patch your WordPress, you are immediately going to get drawn into one of these types of platforms. It just it just happens. We've also got a report here from Catalin Kimpanu of Bleeping Computer. Symantec has taken a bit of a look at some, pretty weak Iranian APT activity.
This is a group there. They're calling Leaf Miner. They've been owning a bunch of stuff around the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, that kind of thing. I think the polite way of saying it is that they are, adaptive to developments in the hacking scene. They appear to be, co-opting whatever shows up, whatever tools, whatever bugs come out, including, amongst other things, using the NSA Fuzzbunch framework, which was released by the Shadow Brokers to run some of their ops, which... Yeah, there's a certain degree of amusement in that. But it doesn't seem like the world's most experienced APT crew, but then again, you don't have to be to get the job done.
Let's see where they're at in 5 years, right?
Well, yeah, I'm sure they'll learn a few lessons from this one. Apparently, Symantec popped one of their C2 boxes via a PHP web shell that they're flying around, and all of their tools were there. So, yes, a couple of lessons to learn for them.
There is a new version of Kronos doing the rounds.
Yes, a new version of Kronos, apparently called Osiris, has many of the same features as earlier versions of Kronos, except the C2 protocol now runs over Tor, which should make things a little more complicated for people. There was some amusement on Twitter with this particular version after MalwareTech, the guy who's Max Hutchins, who's currently awaiting legal charges or facing legal charges in the US for developing, amongst other things, the Kronos banking Trojan. So it's nice to see new versions come out whilst he is kicking around waiting for trial.
Even in his absence. he's been over there a year now. So, you'd hope that they're actually going to resolve this thing soon because it has been a while. Now this looks like really interesting research, but I'm not sure if I'm jumping on the hype train. I wanted to talk to you first. It's Spectre-related research, but it's called NetSpectre, and it looks like you don't even need to get code exec to trigger it. But what does it get you? Is this a big deal? Tell me everything you know.
So, yeah, this is it's a good story, this one. The NetSpectre, so this is from the same people who did some of their other work on speculative execution bugs, and it's interesting for a couple of reasons. So they put out this research paper describing NetSpectre, and essentially what they do is they've broken it down into, a couple of basic primitives of, here is a thing which we can cause to influence to cache a certain thing, and here's a thing we can use to measure whether a certain thing is cached. And then they went looking for those primitives in things which are kind of network accessible remotely that don't require code execution, through JavaScript or something else on the actual system in question, and then try and, kind of average out the behavior of the network in assessing the timing, side channel of reading the behavior of the cache. And the paper they've published kind of describes doing that for a certain kind of class of code construct where the processor is going to, be in the process of validating some user input from the network, and there's going to be a couple of steps of validation, and what they can do is kind of train the branch predictor on the remote CPU to follow one branch of that validation, i.e. the fail case, and then measure in another place in the application whether or not that branch was taken. So kind of like they kind of describe it as a method of skipping out one of the steps of validation and being able to measure it. Net result of kind of combining this all together that they describe in the way that they describe is, you know, the ability to leak some bits out of memory, like one, you know, kind of one bit over, you know, something like a million or 100,000 requests or something. They aim for, what was it, they describe an attack which is like 15 bits an hour in their example, up to 60 bits in certain circumstances that you could leak out. And, you know, there may be some scenarios where that is enough to do some good things. One of the examples they give in their paper is, you know, de-ASLRing locations in memory. So if you're in some other attack where you want to leak an offset,
that's an interesting way to get it to figure out a memory offset, right?
Well, yeah, yes, it is. It seems like quite a long way around. And I imagine there are some other scenarios, but the thing is, it's quite a specific kind of construct that they describe. I guess,
I guess what it all boils down to is this is very much one of those, at this stage, one of those more sort of academic bits of research, which is like, hey, cool, but I can't imagine you're going to be using this in any red team exercises anytime soon.
No, I don't think it's, you know, it's certainly not off the shelf, let's roll kind of ready. But, you know, then again, we kind of said that about Rowhammer, and I haven't Rowhammered anything on a red team either.
But you can see the day when you might.
But yeah, you can kind of see the path forward. So no, it's certainly worth keeping an eye on. I mean, and the, you know, one of the things we've seen with security technology overall is we start with, you know, very specific tricks that we use to hack a thing. And then over time, we learn what the generic components of that trick are. Like the way we describe, a memory corruption exploit in terms of a write for primitive these days, where we understand much better how to turn these things into their primitive components and then be flexible about how we implement those primitives. And I think that's kind of where we're heading with this kind of speculative execution class of bugs, is we're better understanding the generic components and then being able to apply them in more flexible ways than we thought previously when we only had very specific examples.
And Adam, this story, it's funny because I'm talking about it again. Last week, I actually did discuss this one with Haroon, but I left it on the cutting room floor because it was just a little meh. But since then, there's been an awful lot of media coverage about it. Tell us about these Bluetooth flaws that are getting so much attention.
Yeah, so there was a research paper that came out about a flaw actually in the kind of cryptographic exchange during a certain type of Bluetooth pairing. It's interesting because it uses elliptic curves and they kind of screw up the one thing that you can screw up with elliptic curve key exchange. And my crypto is not quite deep enough to understand the specifics of that, but it has been getting a bunch of coverage. And I guess the question that most people have asked, you know, when we were talking about this around the office last week is like, is this at pairing time or is it later on in the process?
And that's what I was trying to figure out as well with Haroon. And I think, you know, we were looking at really early stage reports, so it wasn't clear. We didn't have time to read the paper, but you know, did you find out?
Yeah. So the answer is yes, it's during pairing time.
Okay.
During the key exchange, during pairing, in particular types of pairing that use this type of elliptic curve and where the implementations are broken in the way that you know matters in this case.
Well, and both implementations need to be broken.
Are broken in that particular way. The point the researchers make is that the spec itself is broken, and if you implement it per the spec, you have a broken implementation. They do point out that Microsoft's implementation is sufficiently old and rubbish that it's not vulnerable to this particular thing because it's not quite standards compliant, so that's good.
That's very Microsoft. By the way.
I think the key takeaway for most people is Bluetooth pairing is a thing you should do in the privacy of your own home, like not in a public location. And, you know, I was kind of the opinion that it was never safe to pair a Bluetooth device, you know, in an untrusted location. So that advice would apply to this attack or any of the other ones.
Well, I don't know any red teamers who use Bluetooth keyboards.
Well, there's a very good reason for that, yes.
You know what I mean? So, like, I don't know. I mean, it seems like a bit of an edge case, but it is getting an awful lot of attention because, I guess, because it's such a ubiquitous technology. But probably not time to panic on that one just yet. Well, what does it get you? Does it get you full man in the middle or?
Yeah, so in 50% of the times, you get the keys derived from the key exchange, which then lets you impersonate either device to each other and decrypt traffic and whatever. So, like, the result is bad, but, you know, if you're pairing the Bluetooth tire pressure sensors on your Tesla with the middle, I don't know if Teslas use Bluetooth tire pressure sensors, but if your car has Bluetooth tire pressure sensors and you're pairing it with the engine control unit at the factory and someone's sitting outside the factory jacking all of the keys, like that could be bad. you know, hopefully maybe do it in a Faraday cage if you're Tesla or somebody else. But
so you might get a low tire pressure warning.
Well, you might blow up the car with Andy Greenberg in it, you know, I don't know. But yeah, so I mean, I think the moral of the story is that if you are a Bluetooth vendor that's doing this kind of thing a lot in bulk, probably worth understanding. For regular consumers with Bluetooth headsets on the bus, just don't pair it on the bus with a hacker with an SDR sitting next to you, you know?
Yeah, if there's someone real shady sitting there with a big antenna, yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe don't.
Maybe not. And this week's skateboarding dog is inmates in a prison in Idaho hacked the prison credit service for $225,000 in like credit tokens. But, you know, you dive into this story and you realize no one actually stole any money. Inmates at this prison are forced to use this privately provisioned service where you have to pay to like be in touch with your loved ones or use their like little internet kiosks and whatnot. And you actually have to pay to use it. And someone just figured out how to add credit to the account. So everyone all of a sudden had $1,000 worth of credit. And, you know, I think, you know, these systems, I don't know, I kind of feel like the state, you know, me being an Australian, I sort of feel like the state should foot the bill for people to communicate with their loved ones when they're in prison. So I'm kind of on the prisoner's side on this one. Does that make me a bad person? I can't decide.
I don't think it makes you a bad person. Like, I went and looked at the website for the vendor in question. This is a company called JPay. They make like kiosks and actually like mobile tablet devices for prisoners to use. And then they sell the devices, of course, because, you know, USA. And then you have to have lots of credit to buy, you know, you can get ebooks and music and you can send emails and video conference and that kind of thing. But yeah, the credit for these things, like the story is that they lost what, $224,000 worth of credits for the system. But it is worth pointing out that like they make you buy stamps for your email. And those stamps come in like packs of 10 for $4, and each page of email, like whatever dumb metric that is, you know, set the font size smaller, rip them off. Costs you, you know, one e-stamp for you. Anyway, it just seems ridiculous to those of us who live outside the US that this is a thing. And yeah, like it does not feel like real money got stolen. So, I'm with you.
We'll have to see if there's any, you know, sentence extensions for those prisoners who I'm sure the prison has working in some sort of call center for 50 cents an hour, which they are in turn using to buy email stamps so that JPay can profit. You scumbags. And on that note, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Of course, it's Las Vegas week next week, so we will not be publishing a show next week. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I'm sure there'll be lots of interesting stories and talks and stuff from the Vegas week. So, yeah, we'll keep an eye out for some juicy things to bring you. And we'll talk to all of your listeners in a couple of weeks.
That was Adam Boileau there of Insomnia Security. And I don't say this enough, but if you are looking for a really high-end pen test and application security testing firm, Insomnia really do kick ass. They're based in New Zealand, but they do have clients all over the globe. They have 25 consultants or thereabouts last time I checked. So, yeah. Okay, before we continue, an announcement. BroCon is coming up October 10 to 12 in Arlington, Virginia. I'm told it is the most important community event for users, developers, incident responders, threat hunters, and architects who rely on the open source Bro Network Security Monitor in their security stack. Join your colleagues who rely on Bro for technical talks, demonstrations, and discussions about the project, its many applications, and its future. If you are interested in the ever-evolving security landscape and how Bro can help your organization by providing better data about network traffic, then head to BroCon 2018. BroCon is supported by CoreLight, providers of a network visibility solution for cybersecurity built on Bro. Early bird pricing has been extended for BroCon 2018, registered by August 10 for the best pricing and to ensure your discounted hotel room. Relevant links are in this week's show notes. Okay, on to this week's feature interview now, a chat with Greg Shipley. So I've known Greg a long time. We're old friends. He was the founder of NeoHapsis in Chicago back in the day. NeoHapsis was a pretty great consultancy, for those of you who don't remember it. He sold that and then went to work for InQtel around 2010, where he did things for a while. And then a couple of years ago, he helped stand up an InQtel initiative called Cyber Reboot. Now, the idea behind Cyber Reboot is it'll do the things the market isn't doing. And one of the things Greg says is a problem is that we don't have a central repository of network metadata that we can use to train machine learning models. We have VirusTotal and other repositories for malware, but when it comes to an Active Directory box looking shady on the LAN, we just don't have a huge dump of typical versus dodgy Active Directory box data to look through. And that's something he and his team want to fix. So they've modified TCP dump to include a sort of private mode. It's something that they want the maintainers to adopt to make the capture of this type of metadata easier, the capture and sharing, I should say, of this data easier. Oh, and you're going to hear in this interview too that I'm now doing some work for Senrio. I may as well announce that I have signed on as an advisor and I've been helping them with a couple of ideas around visualizations and also worked with them a bit on messaging. They do have a new website, so do check it out. And yeah, you know, if you find the idea of actually being able to see everything on your network by crunching passively collected network metadata, then you'll probably like what Senrio's put together there. But anyway, Greg joined me to talk about what he's been up to with the TCP dump stuff and a bunch of other stuff too. Here he is.
One of our lab's goals is to try and drive cost and complexity up for the adversary and down for the defender. Life is hard enough for defenders, and so we want to try and explore things that maybe rebalance that a little bit. So we started this project a couple of years ago called Poseidon, and Poseidon's goals were twofold. Was one, try and better understand what is on the network, because one of the dirty little secrets of the IT industry is that you get to a network of any reasonable size, and most defenders actually don't know what's on it, even in 2018. So Poseidon goal number one was help identify what is on the network. And we did this through a combination of using software-defined networks and machine learning algorithms. And then the second goal was to hopefully identify when that device is acting oddly, right? So when your VoIP phone starts looking more like a desktop workstation or your printer starts looking more like a file server. And to do those, we went down the path of machine learning. And as you know, to successfully train machine learning models, one needs good data. You don't have good data science without good data. And that's where we ran into our first problem.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I mean, this is all very familiar to me because I'm doing some work with the fine folks over at Senrio, and their whole brief is to actually do exactly what you just described. They started off in the IoT space, and as it turns out, you don't need uber sophisticated machine learning to be able to tell when an embedded device is malfunctioning. When you kick it up to computers and general IT, that is where it gets a lot. That's where it gets much more complicated. But you know, you're right. There's no VirusTotal for network metadata, is there? That's suspicious network metadata. You can't find good samples.
No, it's really rough. The team was actually kind of interesting because we had people from all sorts of different backgrounds. So we had people that have more of a data science background, people like me who have a more information security and networking background, other folks with development backgrounds. And so when you work with data scientists, you know, their first question is what does your data look like? What does your corpus of data look like? And we're trying to study traffic patterns and coming from endpoints on a corporate network, right? So not things zooming around at the perimeter, but like, hey, what does your Active Directory controller look like? What does your internal GitHub controller or system look like? What are your file servers? What are your developer workstations look like? And corporations don't really want to share that.
It's quite reasonable that they don't want to share that.
Yeah, absolutely. But it really, the fact that we don't have a corpus to train off of really slows down advancement in that domain. So if you look at obviously image recognition has exploded. If I can go get a million dog pictures and a million cat pictures, and I can train the heck out of a bunch of models to identify a dog or a cat. And obviously audio has started to explode too. But network traffic, not so much, turns out.
No, and look, one of the things that you mentioned to me before we started doing this interview is you've created a version of TCP dump that strips payload, right? And that, again, this is very similar to the stuff that Senrio do. It's like MAC address or device aware metadata. They're not really interested in payload. But I appreciate where you're coming from with that, but I do also wonder about the inherent paradox there, which is like, oh, we've stripped out the payload information so that, you know, this stuff is more benign and presents less of a risk to your organization if it gets out there. But you're also positing that you can learn an awful lot from that metadata, which you can. You're going to learn a lot about a network, even if you don't have the payloads of the packets, right?
Yeah. So yeah, to give kind of a little more background there, we found when we talked to people that the two areas, for better or worse, the two areas that people are the most concerned about were, one, the contents in a network packet. So obviously, you know, you look in HTTP packet, there's stuff in there. You know, this is where your Word docs and your mail and also your PDFs and all sorts of other stuff reside. So people are concerned about what's in the payload of pretty much anything, you know, whether it's DNS or mail or web or whatever. The other thing that they were concerned about was who they were talking to, right? So on the external internet. Now, I'm not going to postulate that one can sanitize everything and then still have useful information. But our thought was the bulk of the sensitive stuff is in those two areas. It's either in payload or it's in IP addresses of that external IP addresses that that node is talking to. So our enhancements were designed to get rid of those two areas. And
so what, you only capture like reserved ranges sort of thing,
yeah,
and you just ditch everything else.
Yep. That's all we really wanted to pay attention for our exercise. Now there's other people that might want to look at other stuff, and you know, there might be challenges associated with that as well. But the other approach that I think would be helpful is if you blend traffic, right? So let's say, we do a sanitized TCP dump from organization A and B and organization C, and we just put them all together in a training pool, right? As long as they're clearly labeled, the data scientist can use it. And, you know, piecing it back together from where it came from, the more people you have in the pool, the harder that becomes. So I wouldn't say that there's zero risk, but it's one of those things where we got to start somewhere or we're just not going to advance this.
So what's the idea here? Do you want people using this modified TCP dump to, you know, run on their networks and then give the data to you? I mean, what's the go?
So that's a great question.
Hey,
so,
we're a CIA-linked organization. Right, please give us your network metadata.
That's all your core data. No, yeah. No, it's a fair question. You know, what's interesting was one of our sister labs, Cosmic Works, they focus heavily on applying machine learning to satellite imagery. And they came up with a very similar problem a couple years ago. And they said, hey, there's a great corpus of like cat and dog database images, but like, what about satellite images? And they wound up kind of pulling off of the whole ImageNet thing. They wound up launching an effort called SpaceNet, which was done in conjunction with Digital Globe and Amazon and NVIDIA. And lo and behold, they have a corpus hosted in Amazon of satellite imagery that data scientists can then execute challenges against. So I don't know if that's the right model, but I think something like that is necessary. The other thing, and this was a kind of an interesting lesson for us on the open source side, is we did these modifications to TCP dump and we tried to get them upstream. And I think we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of pushing in a pull request and having them not respond. And so there's a few challenges here. One of them is just getting the tools out there that allow one to do this. And then the other is, who houses this?
Well, that's the question, right? Like, are you proposing that you would, just so that you can collect this corpus and then, you know, maybe loan it out to people? I mean, what's the plan?
Yeah. So, well, first we hopefully got to get this upstreamed, but after that, we'd like to launch.
So you mean it'd be like a command line option to do this with TCP?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about TCP dump, and the reason we picked this is you might be thinking, well, there's got to be someone who's done payload sanitization. Yeah, we actually went out and looked, and there's a lot of like orphaned code out there, or things that crash or things that only run on Windows. And so the team kind of thought, well, what would be the easiest way to do this? And what would be the easiest way to get this in the hands of a lot of people? And TCP dump is everywhere. Like it's on Mac OS X. It's in pretty much every Linux distro out there. So our thinking is that if we could get that no payload flag in there, then we would give the world a tool that is they already have.
And then perhaps some of the established vendors might be able to grab traffic samples. I mean, they'd build it into their T's and C's that they could do this, grab some anonymized network data, pull it together. That's kind of the idea.
Yeah, that is the idea. Now, the question that you're asking though is, hey, how do we do an image net for PCAP data? And we have some thoughts, but we're not there yet. And to your point, you know, people might be concerned if there's only one entity that's kind of housing all this stuff. So we're open to suggestions. So if people have suggestions, we're all ears.
Now, what do you make of the organizations? Because there are some vendors now that are claiming to do, some pretty advanced machine learning stuff on the network. The one that immediately springs to mind is Darktrace. What do you make of these vendors now? I mean, if you're here on the show to say, look, we don't really have decent enough training sets, then how is it possible that these vendors are claiming to be quite successful in this space already?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'd say there's two things I would bring to the table on that one. So one, I think that machine learning absolutely can be applicable to certain use cases in the networking domain. And I'm sure a bunch of these vendors have collected a bunch of data. Now, are they willing to share that data? From my experience, no. But the people are doing the same thing that we did, which was they're going out and getting a corpus themselves. I think everyone will benefit if we share more, but
I'm really understanding the pitch a lot better now, which is just that you want to enable the sort of, the easy collection of data that's valuable for profiling and training. That makes a lot of sense.
I think there's one other thing, though, that's probably worth mentioning, too, is, and this might be us being overambitious, but one of the things software-defined networking allows you to do is programmatically interface with the network, which in some cases, that's pretty buzzy. Why does that benefit anyone? What are you really talking
master
about there?
Master span port.
it's
good, right? Like, I know exactly where you're going with this.
Yeah. So if I, historically, if I was running in a traditional data center and, I wanted to capture traffic from port 15 and switch 22 and somehow pop that out at the other end of the data center and port 2 of switch 57, I would be SSHing to a whole lot of switches and routers and doing a lot of stuff. And in the SDN world, at least with some of the stuff out there, that's three API calls.
Yeah, but you got to be careful. Right? You got to know your architecture because otherwise you can – the problem with software-defined networking, if you ask it to do too much, it will. It will try.
Yeah. You shoot your foot off. Yeah, you absolutely can. But I think that's true in a lot of domains.
Absolutely. Hey, look, I want to move on to our next topic, right? Yeah. Because another thing you've been paying a lot of attention to is the so-called deception space. Listeners would have heard me say – I think I've said this on the show before – that I believe deception is more of a feature than a product. I mean, you've got very niche products like Thinx Canary, but I really like the stuff that Rapid7 does with bogus service accounts and things like that. But that's part of their incident detection and response platform. That's not a deception play. Their security software. And, there's some development frameworks that have certain deception elements in them. But I just want to ask you, I mean, you're a longtime industry watcher. You've done a lot of great work over the years. I'm really curious to know what your immediate thoughts are on deception tech.
Yeah. So I think, let me preface this with, we're still in the middle of investigating this. So these are kind of like our preliminary thoughts, but, it appears that the technique itself, and there's a bunch of different ways this can be implemented. We can talk about those, but it appears that the technique itself, could be useful, to better detect adversaries moving around the network. The question I think you and everyone else rightfully asks is that is this a product or is this a feature? And I think the jury's still out on that, but I tend to be leaning towards more of it being a feature.
See, and again, we had this conversation before I hit record, but like I just keep imagining some of these really fiddly, complicated deception plays, right? They rely heavily on orchestration. They need to be hooked into some pretty sensitive parts of your infrastructure. And I can just imagine a red teamer like, for example, Adam Boileau, taking that and then using it to own a company sideways, right? Like anything that complicated just seems like a bad idea.
Yeah, well, when step one is, you know, install rootkit everywhere, or step one is, you know, place appliance that is now connected to every VLAN you have, that might not be the best approach in a production environment. But, you know, there were two of my colleagues, a gentleman by the name of Mike Holm and another one by Mike Ferrari, did a really good market survey looking at, you know, all the deception tech coming out of a bunch of different countries, actually. And, you know, they kind of boiled it down to four areas that they saw people building out features for. You know, one is the network, one is the endpoint, one is kind of the application layer, and one is the data layer. And I think all of those areas, there's room to deploy things in an enterprise environment that could help drive better detection. I'm just not sure if that's like a standalone thing, or that's to one of your points that you made earlier. Do you just put some canary accounts in Active Directory? You know, do you just put
gets you a long way, right? Like, that's the funny thing with deception. And it's just, I love it that it's got its own buzzword now. But, you know, just something as simple as canary accounts. I mean, that is old thinking that finally is getting some applied use. And, you know, that's a pretty, pretty big red alert in your SIEM console.
Yeah. Yeah. If you do it right, you know, That's the other challenge. I mean, this actually applies to the machine learning side too. I think one of the challenges that the industry faces in general is we consistently come up with these better mousetraps. And then at the end of that kind of workflow, it's like, and then alert the human, right? Mm. And at some point as an industry, we've got to get the confidence to take that next step, which is automate in action. Because if everything is always driving towards alert the human, guess what? We continue to overwhelm the human, which has been a problem for how long?
Yeah, it does feel like swinging back to like the IPS days, right? And you remember what a disaster it was the last time we tried this, right? Because you'd wind up sniping that much legitimate traffic and just causing all sorts of drama, right? So do you think we're actually ready to give it a second attempt?
I think with select use cases, we probably are, but you know,
someone recently made the point to me that, you know, if you actually, to actually set up something that does active response, the amount of effort that you need to put in to actually tune it correctly for your environment is better spent elsewhere. Like, you know, if you if you're going to put in that many hours, you know, do something else.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's fair. And again, I think it depends on what exactly you're doing. Right. But the other challenge is to the gentleman's point who made that comment, you know, what's the current state of your environment, right? Like, should you be playing around with deception tech when you don't have your patches deployed in under 30 days? Like, probably not.
The security industry loves selling, you know, next generation, best of breed, right? And most people are still running around running, you know, 90s networks.
Yeah. And that's a hard one to suss out, right? You know, you have to be this high, you have to be this high to ride, you know, this ride.
Yeah.
this tall. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Well, I wish you the best of luck, especially with, you know, getting your stuff into TCP dump so that people may use it. Because that seems like a pretty easy terms and conditions sell for vendors who might already be on the network. And I guess if you just give them this capability on a silver platter, I guess you're hoping they'll do something useful with it. So best of luck with that. And Greg, it's great to have you back in the public domain chatting away, and hope to have you on the show again soon.
Hey, my pleasure. And thanks for having me.
That was Greg Shipley of Cyber Reboot there. Big thanks to him for that. Time for a quick correction now. Last week, I interviewed two gentlemen from Iceberg, Jason Rebholz and Justin Warner, and I incorrectly referred to Jason as Justin in my introduction to the show and also my introduction to the segment. Sorry about that, Jason. It was just a silly mistake I made when I was writing my links. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Dave Lewis of Duo Security. Duo Security is, and I don't think it is at all a stretch to say this, they are the best provider of multi-factor authentication software. If you are planning to make the switch to 2FA, roll out 2FA on your network, which you absolutely should be doing, then you want Duo's stuff. Strong authentication is a major enabler, too, of Zero Trust networks. And Google has slapped a brand on Zero Trust called BeyondCorp, and Duo has really embraced this concept. The idea is the security of your endpoints becomes less and less relevant as you move to a model that is very dependent on strong authentication and strong application security. As you'll hear in this interview, the way I explain it, zero trust generally, is just pretend your LAN is the open internet and then restructure things accordingly. Well, Dave Lewis is Duo's advisory CISO, and he joined me to talk about roadblocks that CISOs might face on the road to the zero trust nirvana. He started off by telling us what his take on zero trust actually is. Here's Dave Lewis.
It's all the things that we should have been doing for 25 years. And now it has a wrapper that you can call zero trust around it, which, I mean, John Kindervag would probably disagree with me vociferously about how I'm articulating it, but it really is about making everything incrementally better than it was. Because, you know, the idea of having a security utopia simply isn't going to, we're not going to get there anytime soon. As long as we have opposable thumbs, we're going to be kind of stuck.
I mean, the way I explain it to people when they ask about zero trust is I just say, imagine that your LAN is in fact the open internet and then just proceed accordingly, right? That's the way I try to explain it.
Well, yeah. And the way I look at it too is very much in that internet meme of the dog sitting there having coffee and everything's on fire around them. That sort of, you know, conceptualizes the idea of, you know, what your network really is. And having been a defender for 20 years before I crossed over into the vendor space, I had my share of, oh, what is that doing on my network? More than I care to admit. Mm. And it really is, it's a constant battle. And you're dealing with, you know, organizations that have limited resources, they have limited bench strength, through no fault of their own other than they simply can't afford to have that dream team, that they need to do everything they can to fight the attackers. And the attackers just keep coming. And
yeah. I think it was in the wake of the Equifax thing, I made some pretty critical comments on the show. And I actually had some CISO friends of mine reach out and say, look, you know, this is just the way it is. And they said, look, our approach is we're trying to sort of zero trust everything that we can and just keep our fingers crossed that our legacy stuff doesn't get owned. I mean, that's, you know, on a wing and a prayer is basically the vibe for people transitioning to this model at the moment, because we did get into a place where we got technical debt that can't be quickly solved, eh?
Well, yeah, exactly that. And it really does boil down to all of these risks that you've accepted over time, they accumulate and that debt grows with a compound interest to the point that when something does go wrong, it has horrible impact. Mm. I mean, just to look at Heartbleed as an example, that was something that was lingering in the code for years before all hell broke loose. It's not the greatest example, but it sort of illustrates how things can grow in the background without proper diligence and, you know, looking into, because they really didn't have the resources to check for these sort of things as part of that project, but they do now.
Yeah. So the topic today is really looking at missteps that lead away from the zero trust model. And I'm imagining that there's quite a few, like projects that might be kicking off in various parts of your organization that you might just want to kill dead or change. Like, what are they? What are those missteps? Because I'm sure people would be quite curious to hear them.
The missteps that I've experienced in my career as I went along would really boil down to project management timelines and the artificial stake in the ground that's set that we have to deliver the project by this date. And in a lot of cases, I was part of a team that had to vet all these projects before they could go live. And more often than not, I would run into project managers who would try to route around us. They would try to bypass us so that, you know, they were trying to get the project in earlier than what was scheduled. And honestly, if they had come and had to sit down with us and gone through this all as a proactive step, it would have been so much cheaper and so much more expeditious to get it done before, rather than having to rip it all out afterwards when they try to go live. Mm. And then they would scream bloody murder all the way up to the C-suite. And then the C-suite goes, well, how did this happen? And we explained to them, well, they bypassed us. And that was the end of the discussion. You know, it's a frustrating thing because it didn't have to be that way.
So hang on. I mean, it's you're speaking in very general terms right now. So can you give us like can you try to give us some sort of example of the type of project that you're talking about? Because without an example, it's sort of a little bit difficult to grasp what you're getting at.
Okay. So for one power company that I was working at, we were in the middle of a smart grid project. And we were rolling out devices across the province. And we found a bug within the firmware on these devices. And we had to fight to inject ourselves into the conversation to actually have the code vetted on these devices. As a result, we were able to find a default username and credentials that were embedded within the firmware on these devices, and we were able to get that rectified. But if we hadn't been as loud and as obnoxious as we had to be, then there's a very real possibility that would have actually been deployed across the province of Ontario and Canada.
Well, and that's how you wind up with technical debt. But does that connect to zero trust networks?
Not in that specific instance, but it is an example of the security debt that you can build up over time. So when you're talking about zero trust, another example is another organization I worked at years ago. We had a security audit done, and they went through and they found a whole mess of individual accounts that were still enabled. One in particular was a gentleman who had left the company 10 years prior and unfortunately had passed away in the interim. This account still had administrative access, still had basically the keys to the kingdom, but it was still enabled. It wasn't disabled. So there wasn't a cohesive staff admin remove process that would have caught that as part of that sort of model where you're looking at limiting who has access to what and being able to actually understand it. There was no centralized management for that. It was literally this account existed in multiple places.
Well, and that is
a good way to manage it.
Yeah, mopping up those sort of problems is an important first step, isn't it, towards moving to a zero trust model. You want to actually get your provisioning, credential provisioning and access provisioning, your ducks in a row.
Well, yeah, there's that. There's the patching on the systems. I mean, all the stuff that I have always looked at as fundamental key pieces of the puzzle. And, there are different interpretations depending on what company you're talking to, what individual talking head you're speaking with about how they see zero trust. I mean, John Kindervag has a very clear idea as to how he sees it. I see it as a vehicle to start a broader conversation. What's the term? How do you define love, right? This is one of those things where you can go, okay, it's different things to different people.
Okay, that's interesting that you're saying that zero trust networks are as hard to define as love. You heard it here first on Risky Business.
and that's the reality of it is, it means different things to different people. But if we are pushing the conversation forward in a cohesive fashion so that we are doing a better job of security, I consider it a win across the board.
So what can you think of a contemporary type of project that people are kicking off that drags them away from a zero trust model?
It really actually boils back to the resources that they have available to them, because a lot of organizations are stuck in firefighting mode, and a lot of the legacy stuff that they're trying to support, they have to worry constantly about the upkeep and maintenance of that, and it chews up the cycles. Every time you have a meeting to talk about a project where you have people from an entire matrix organization in the room, look around the room. How many people are in that room? How much does it cost the organization, in not only in time, but in money? So these are the things where you're pulling away from doing a better job of security. I was very fortunate that I got to work in an organization years ago where they rolled out ITIL. And they took an entire year where the CIO said there will be no new projects during this time. We're going to concentrate specifically on this so we can have to find a repeatable process as we make sure that we do a better job. As a result, this worked out rather effectively. The rate of incidents dropped precipitously, and we were able to do a better job. So this I looked at as a stepping stone towards getting where we needed to go. Obviously, not every organization has the luxury of being able to do that sort of
thing. But I guess what you're saying is a misstep might be just continuing business as usual and not really addressing the elephant in the room, which is that you're dedicating, 75% of your resources just to managing these hideous things while you're pushing ahead with your remaining 25% of resources to build projects that are going to just add to the problem.
Absolutely. It's like, ignoring the elephant standing on the front lawn. Yeah. It is there no matter how you put it. You can walk around it all day long, but eventually you're going to have to deal with it.
Bloody elephants. Now, I think, Dave, you, like others, are firmly of the opinion that the first step to this unachievable, frankly unachievable state of security nirvana is to improve processes rather than buy blinky light boxes. I mean, that's you're squarely in the camp of people who believes that, blinky light boxes will not solve your problem.
Well, they will solve pieces of the problem. The bigger problem that they have to address is the process, the defined repeatable processes, and how they can do things in a way that is going to reduce the rate of incidents, reduce the risk to the organization. And it's all about managing risk when you break down to the core of it. And this is really something that most organizations don't want to do, because it's much like, you know, manual log review. Nobody actually wants to do it, but they know they have to.
So let me ask you a generic question about, you know, zero trust. What would you think are the first sort of key steps that organizations should undertake just in order to start moving in that direction? Like, how do you even begin? Because I imagine there's a lot of CISOs listening who are like, you know, hey, I'd love to have a zero trust network. I'd love to, you know, I'd love this all singing, all dancing thing that is a manageable thing. But where do I even begin? So that would be a good question. Like, where do you begin with this?
All right. So a core fundamental piece that they can tackle right out of the gate is having a clear, defined device inventory for their enterprise. If they don't know what's on their network, how are they going to be able to best protect it? The second part is having a clear understanding as to the users that are on your network and what they have access to and what level of access they have. I've been in, unfortunately, too many companies where you have local administrative privileges on servers and other types of systems that are not centrally managed. So if you're unable to manage these devices in a cohesive fashion, this can come back and bite you. So those are the two first steps that I would look at right out of the gate.
You need to know everything on your network so that you can sort of make their security irrelevant, almost, like, because that's kind of what zero trust is about, right? But a big first step is finding out, well, what's on my network? What do I need to care about so that I don't need to care about it later?
Exactly. And there's been too many times where I'd have conversations with folks and I said, okay, how many Windows servers do you have on your network? How many Linux boxes do you have on your network? What type are they? And they would say a lot. And this is not a clear answer.
Well, they just say, that is a good question.
yeah. And that's just it. If they don't know what's on their network, how are they going to protect it? So, I mean, a core fundamental is knowing what is on your network before you can get to all the other bits and pieces.
All right, Dave Lewis, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat, to muse on some of this zero trust stuff. And we will be seeing you, of course, in Las Vegas at summer camp. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Cheers.
That was Dave Lewis of Duo Security there. Big thanks to him for that. Do head over to duo.com to check out their products and also check out their blog for a whole bunch of really good content on Zero Trust networks. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm on break next week over in the USA, but I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.